Streaming now on TuneIn and the Odyssey app. AM 1100 KFAX.
Portions of our programming may be pre-recorded.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
First off today, let's concentrate a bit on the markets. I know a lot of people are feeling a bit nervous these days, and perhaps justifiably so. We've seen the markets just beaten up over the last many, many months related to not just inflationary fears, but also the increase, of course, in interest rates. That while the Fed is attempting to try and cool inflation, is perhaps having a chilling effect on the health of the economy. Now, there is some mixed news. And I will, with great candor, tell you that it's a bit of a mixed bag. First, good news today, jobless claims are down for the fifth straight week in a row. In addition to that, the August Producer Price Index, essentially the wholesale price, they're related to inflation. They are now seeing the second straight month of less rates of inflation than had been anticipated. But a lot of this seems to right now, particularly in relationship to last week's 1,200-point drop, a lot of it seems to be turning on fears of investors that when the Fed meets next Wednesday and Thursday, that they're going to once again increase interest rates. Let's get more on this, and we've got some other things to talk about, too, related to Amazon being in the news and not in a good way. I'll tell you more about that. Meanwhile, we welcome economist, public speaker, and, of course, the publisher of the Affluent Investor Daily, Jerry Boyer. Jerry, it's always good to have you with us.
Craig, it's always great to be with you.
Let's unpack a little bit of the most recent news. Boy, we kind of had bated breath last week when we saw the points, the Dow rather, drop 1,200 points in one day. And we've seen from the highs of pushing what was nearly 37,000 now hovering barely just above 31,000, making some folks nervous, particularly for those of us old enough to remember that the last time we saw over a period of time a 6,000-something point cumulative drop was clear back in 2008-2009, I think March of 2009, and it led to a pretty significant wallop on the economy. Now, certainly the numbers are higher these days, so there's less panic, but there are ongoing fears, not only related to inflation, but what's the Fed going to do next week? What do you think?
Yeah, a 6,000-point drop when it's 36,000, you know, is a sixth. When it's 18,000, it's a third. So 6,000-point drop is a little more tolerable now than it was back then, but it's still a problem and a pretty clear recessionary signal. I mean, it's been a tough year. It's been a tough month. And it's really almost entirely driven by Fed policy. And that's a problem. And I'm not saying it's a problem that Fed policy might be pushing us into a recession. I'm saying it's a problem that the Fed is this powerful. So the Fed is now overwhelmingly the largest player in markets, in financial markets. In any given day, the big buyer, the biggest buyer or the biggest seller is our own government, our own central bank. It's managing money, which gives it an incredible amount of power. That's problem number one. Problem number two is it's been given a contradictory dual mandate. Mandate one is, well, you need to fight inflation, which means you need to hike interest rates. Mandate two is, oh, we can't slow the economy down. We can't have a recession. We can't have high unemployment. So you need to lower interest rates. So every day, market participants, investors, people like you and me, whether we're pros or amateurs, whatever, DIY, we have to sift through the news, and every statistic that comes out, we have to ask, not necessarily is this good for the economy or bad for the economy, or is this good for business or bad for business, but instead, the one question that matters is, how will the Fed interpret this? In other words, we're looking at these chicken entrails to try to guess, not to try to understand the fundamentals of the economy, but to try to guess what big brother of money, the Fed, is going to do. And what happened is this week we had an inflation report which was worse than expected, which means the Fed was going to switch to the fight inflation mandate, which means they were going to be hiking interest rates, they were going to be selling, and that drove down markets. And of course, when they do that, when they're selling, when they're not putting money into the credit system, tend to hurt markets. Not only does that push down the prices of investment assets, but it also is a signal that there isn't going to be enough credit. And that's why there's a relationship between falling markets and a bad economy. When the Fed tightens too much, not only does it drive down the stock market and the bond market along with it, but it also runs the risk of shrinking credit so that business has to cut back, the very definition of a recession.
You know, and I have to wonder, in a sense, if the Fed has kind of painted itself into its own corner here. I mean, you look back historically, and while we can certainly lay a lot of the current frustration over interest rates and the way the Fed is managing things squarely at the feet of Jerome Powell, his predecessors, both Janet Yellen as well as Bernanke, and Bernanke, if I think, was kind of given credit for guiding us through the difficulties of 2008-2009, even though it was a painful experience across the board. Many people's retirement portfolios took a big-time hit. Real estate, especially in now overheated markets like the San Francisco Bay Area, took a real significant hit. And it just seems as if, you know, there's been this artificially low period of inflation that, not inflation, of interest rates, that maybe almost foolishly they had suppressed for so long, instead of allowing the market to do what it does naturally and allowing some degree of natural ebb and flow to take place. So now you've got, you know, all of this frothiness going on. And so, you know, is it any wonder that it's got investors spooked, and therefore the reason why we saw the 1,200-point drop last week? And I would suspect, as there's talk I'm hearing now, that when they meet, the Federal Open Market Committee meets next Wednesday and Thursday, they may potentially increase the overnight rate as high as another 75 basis points. Now, we've gone from what we're concerned about the Fed might do to what the Fed has actually done. What kind of a wet blanket impact is that going to have on the long-term health of the economy, do you think?
Well, the markets are answering that question right now. They're forward-looking, and the markets are voting that it's going to have a negative impact on the economy. And, you know, I'm glad you pointed out the interest rate suppression, the artificial stimulus, pushing down interest rates, basically just, buying, driving up the price of assets and creating new money to do it. Because in general, when people are evaluating these Fed chairmen, the Bernanke or whatever, right, they kind of look at how they handle the crisis, right? We have a crisis, and how much should they raise interest? If things are really bad, how much should they lower to get us through the Great Recession, et cetera? And in my view, that is not the right time to be evaluating them. The real time frame to evaluate them isn't how they deal with the popping of the bubble, but the role that they played in creating the bubble in the first place. If somebody makes a lot of terrible decisions, let's say somebody falls into addiction, for example, they have to make tough decisions, right? They might lose their house, they might lose their car, might lose a marriage, they have to go into recovery, they have to make all sorts of difficult, decisions, and they're really painful ones, and there's no easy way out. The main thing is not to get addicted in the first place. The main thing is, and easy money is addictive. The main thing is to not engage in financial manipulation to avoid, say, a minor recession or something like that. The main thing is not to pump money into the economy so that we can get a 70% home ownership rate so some politician can brag about it, which gave us a housing bubble, which burst in the Great Recession. The main thing is not to shut down the entire economy over COVID and then quadruple the money supply to make us feel better about that. The main thing is not to create the bubble in the first place so we don't have to deal with the, sort of Hobson's choice of, I don't know, how do we get through it? How much do we fight inflation, and how much do we worry about not causing a recession? Because at this point, there are no good options. Every option has pain associated with it. So the Fed, if the Fed fights enough to beat inflation, it has to cause a recession. If the Fed says a recession is intolerable, then it won't beat inflation. We no longer have a painless option ahead of us. And I do hope to God that next time, after we're through this crisis, we have the common sense to get the Fed back to its basic function, which is just to maintain the value of the dollar and not to monetarily micromanage business cycles.
Yeah, the irony, too, we think back to all of the debacle of 2008, 2009 with the real estate derivatives, and then, of course, on the heels of that, creating interest rates and money so cheap that it was ridiculous. I mean, when inflation is equal to the interest rate, that's probably great while everybody is making money. But then, of course, we saw the government continue to borrow and spend, and you can afford paying off those loans at 2%. Now, when it reaches 4, 5, 6%, it becomes an entirely new ball game. And I guess as we look at the current trajectory, I mean, we're halfway through the month. That means we're just 2 weeks shy of concluding the third quarter. And correct me if I'm wrong, Jerry, but isn't kind of the running definition of a recession is marked by two consecutive quarters of high inflation and market downturn?
You don't need the high inflation. That just makes it worse. Even if you don't have the inflation, two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth is the dictionary definition of a recession. It is the definition of a recession in futures contracts, and it is the legal definition of recession. The Biden administration tried to say when they had their second quarter of negative growth, oh, well, that's not really officially what a recession is. A recession is whatever the National Bureau of Economic Research says it is. No, that's not true. The dictionary and the law say otherwise. So we had a recession. The first 6 months of this year were a recession. Are we still in one or not? Well, we won't find out for sure. It might be that the third quarter were slightly positive. But, you know, the market is acting like we're probably going to have another dip. So we can have like 2 months, we can have two quarters of negative, one quarter of positive, and then another two quarters of negative. That's actually a pretty reasonable outlook. And honestly, I would rather have a short, sharp recession, pop the bubble, find the new level, and get on with life, rather than this just ongoing drip, drip, drip of high inflation and stagnation, something the Keynesians said was impossible until the 1970s, and they had to invent a new word for it, stagflation. Stagflation is exactly what we have now. And why do we have stagflation now like we did in the 70s? Because we have the same policy mix now that we had in the 70s. It's not bad luck. It's not weather systems. Certain policies lead to certain economic outcomes. Carter economics led to the Carter stagflation, and Biden economics leads to the Biden stagflation.
Indeed so. And, of course, you couple that with this great degree of which things turn on either fear or greed, and currently the meter is in the fear category pretty solidly. Then you've got the artificial manipulation going on by the Fed and that sense of uneasiness out there. And, you know, Jerry, when I was a kid, and if I would, out playing in the park or whatever, would fall and skin my knee, and Grandma would put the Band-Aid on. When it was time for the Band-Aid to come off, it was always a desire to take it off nice and slowly. And my grandmother used to say, you know what, my advice to you is let's take it off in one fell swoop, so that you don't prolong the pain anymore. It might sting for a moment, but then it gets over with and you're on to recovery. And I'm afraid that a lot of folks here would rather take the approach of pulling the Band-Aid off slowly, which, of course, only exacerbates and exaggerates the length of pain. And so that's kind of where we find ourselves. Jerry Bowyer with us today. He is the publisher of Affluent Investor Daily. Information available, by the way, on the web at affluentinvestor.com. We're unpacking issues related to current market trends, where things are for just the overall health and well-being of the financial life of the average American. And also coming up in today's program, we're going to spend a little time talking about Amazon. They're back in the news. In fact, a couple of stories in the news, neither of which are very flattering. We'll get to details on that as our conversation continues, as Lifeline continues right here on KFAX.
Streaming at KFAX.com, Odyssey app. Service of Salem Media Group. And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Jerry Bowyer, economist, best-selling author, and the publisher of Affluent Investor Daily is with us today. We're talking about what's going on in the world of money, the markets, and it almost takes a scorecard to keep track of what's happening these days. And, you know, as we were referring to prior to the break, Jerry, in many respects, this is kind of a artificially created mess that we're facing, not to suggest that the impact of COVID, supply chain issues, et cetera, was not something that not just we, but nations across the planet have been dealing with. My goodness, I read last week that the country of the United Kingdom is dealing with like an 11% inflation rate during the month of August. So, you know, there's a lot of pain out there to be sure, but a lot of it unique to the United States is really almost, I don't know if it's fair to say it is a artificially created crisis, but it kind of leans on that in relationship to what's happened with Fed monetary policy, doesn't it?
Yeah, these are self-inflicted wounds. It's not fate, you know, that did this. It's something that we did to ourselves. And you know, I mean, you mentioned Britain. You know, 11% inflation. Britain's got a serious problem, and Europe has a serious problem. So we're probably still better off than most of the world, but we're worse off than we should be. We could be a lot better than the rest of the world. And in some sense, what's protecting us, and we're seeing this in markets, is even though we're making a lot of policy mistakes, and the chaos in other places is in some ways even worse. And so capital is flowing here. Like, for instance, this week we had a down market, but the global markets were down more, and the same for last week. So that causes some capital. So if you're an investor anywhere on planet Earth, you know, you have to invest someplace, right? I mean, you're trying to provide for your future. And even if things don't look great in the United States, you also have to look around and say, but do they look better here than other places? And you look at Europe, which is essentially going to freeze this winter because of an energy crisis that there's almost nothing they can do about. And that's bad energy policy that goes back a long way. That's bad regulatory policy that goes back a long way. And frankly, that's a mishandling of the eastern border to some degree. You know, a combination of provocation towards Russia, but also weakness. I mean, it's kind of the worst combination of scream loudly, but don't carry a big stick. And then China with their, you know, top-down control and their lies about COVID, and then COVID spreads, and then they have to shut down entire provinces. So the world is worse than us in general, and so that's propping us up. So my point is, our markets would be doing even worse. If we were just being graded on how well we're doing just in isolation, markets would be down more. But thankfully, to some degree, investors have to grade on a curve. They have to say, how well are we doing compared to the rest of the world? And the rest of the world is so bad now that actually we've got some capital flowing here. Otherwise, things with our inflation would be worse, and our bear market would be worse, and so would our recession.
Yeah, it's just an uncomfortable, as they say, picture that's been painted here. And of course, sadly, the ones that are suffering the most is the little guy. It's the man or woman who has money in an IRA or a 401k and was looking forward to retiring maybe in the next year or two. That's probably, if not going to be delayed, or if they proceed with it, they might end up retiring from one job and then, you know, getting the greeter position at Walmart or whatever in order to be able to supplement their income. And even to Social Security comes out and announces one of the largest cost of living increases in probably our lifetime. You might have to go back to the Carter years, perhaps, to see the last time that they were talking about these numbers. But sadly, even to say, look at that, they're going to get grandma, grandpa's going to get 8% more next year. But when they consider the fact that under the Obama administration, they redefined the way in which Social Security calculates inflation by conveniently leaving out probably two of the most impacted categories by inflation, food and fuel. So if you never eat, never go anywhere, grandma and grandpa are going to be just fine. Aside from that, it's going to be a cold winter.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be tough, and especially for retirees who don't have much margin. It's always people without margin who are hurt the most. When you have this kind of inflation and this kind of a recession, wealthy people don't change their lifestyle. They don't have to. They don't eat less. You know, they don't, you know, they just have less numbers on a spreadsheet. But the poor and middle class, life actually changes. So this really matters to them, which is why I think we're seeing a revolt at the ballot box. And here's the thing. You're talking about the cost of living adjustment for Social Security. Okay, and there should be, right? I mean, we made promises to retirees, and their cost of living did go up, and it is a retirement program. It's supposed to compensate them for that, but that has a budgetary impact. So Social Security, you know, what is Social Security Trust Fund? What does it own? It owns Treasury bonds. What's happened to Treasury bonds in the past year? Treasury bonds have gotten the living snot beat out of them. It is a very poor performing asset class. So the Social Security Administration has to pay more out because of the cost of living adjustments, but its value has been shrinking because it owns an asset class, Treasury bonds, which have performed very poorly because of Fed policy. So if you're someone like me who believes that we have a demographic problem leading to a probable Social Security crisis, these events are an acceleration towards that crisis. We will hit that wall sooner because of the sell-off in Treasury bonds and the cost of living adjustment, which increases the outflow from the Social Security Trust Fund.
Wow. There's a mixed bag here, and it, as I said before, it takes a scorecard to keep track. One final question before we take a break, and then I want to switch up our subject matter. Your sense in terms of the meeting next week, Thursday and Wednesday, the Federal Open Market Committee will meet. I referenced earlier in my opening remarks the possibility of potentially as much as 75 basis point increase. Do you think it'll be that, at least minimally?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the futures market, skin in the game. Markets are smarter than pundits, even though I'm a pundit, so I admit that. So I'm looking at the futures market. I think 75 basis points is really the minimum. Given what happened with inflation this week, what happened this week is markets said 75 basis point hike or maybe 100. Inflation is still running pretty hot, so it's 75 or 100. If it's 100, that'll hit markets. I'm not saying it shouldn't be. That might be the painful thing we need to do to withdraw from the morphine drip of easy money. But that's still painful. But I would be very shocked if they did less than 75% or 75 basis point hike.
So that being the case, that means it's going to cost not only a lot more money to buy a car, it's going to cost a lot more money to buy a home. The refund market, I think, effectively at this juncture, if the final nail hasn't been driven in the coffin, the Fed will see to that next week. And then you're going to see, of course, a significant slowing. Now, this may help to decrease housing prices, particularly in overheated markets like the San Francisco Bay Area. But then if conversely, so the prices go down, but then the cost of borrowing money goes up, you're kind of still in the same place in terms of real estate, aren't you?
Right. You're not ahead of the game because what you pay is a mortgage. Like, you don't actually pay the value of your house. You pay a number that's a calculation of the principal times the mortgage amount. So if mortgage rates rise and house prices lower to adjust to that, you're not ahead of the game. You're just where you were before. You didn't gain anything.
Ouch, ouch, ouch. Well, folks, time to hang on to your wallets, to be sure, because it's going to be a bumpy ride. We're talking about all things related to the markets, the world of money. When we come back, I want to switch up the topic and talk a bit about Amazon. They've been in the news lately and not in a good way. What's it all about, Alfie? We'll find out next as our conversation with Jerry Boyer, the publisher of the Affluent Investor Daily, continues here on this edition of Lifeline.
This is Alistair Begg, inviting you to join me on the Deeper Faith cruise to Canada and New England this coming September. Together, we'll be studying from God's Word, enjoying Christian fellowship, and all the while taking in the beautiful fall scenery. It looks like it'll be a terrific adventure, and I hope that you'll come along. You can learn more and book your ticket online at deeperfaithcruise.com or call 855-565-5519.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
You've heard me make a couple of references to Amazon and perhaps with bated breath wondering exactly what's going on. Well, a couple of things we can touch on. First, news today that Amazon's in a bit of hot water with the state of California, the state taking legal action against Amazon. A lawsuit filed against the retail giant for blocking price competition, causing increased prices on the platform. Now, apparently, Amazon had been requiring merchants to enter into exclusivity agreements that severely penalized them if their products were offered for a lower price anywhere else. Maybe you call that a modern-day form of old-fashioned price fixing, I don't know. But in addition to that bit of trouble, there's also a story in the news that is not getting as much coverage, but I think is equally important. A lot of folks are perhaps aware of the fact that when you're an Amazon Prime member at checkout, you have opportunities to support your favorite charity. And I think something like a half percentage of your purchase is then given to or donated to the charity of your choice. And it's a pretty broad list of charities out there that folks can choose from. But suddenly now it seems as if Amazon Smile program has decided not to smile, but instead frown on an organization that we have been very supportive of. You've heard the folks from Alliance Defending Freedom on this program many, many times. They are a religious freedom advocacy legal firm. They do all their work pro bono, and they're getting a frown from Amazon. Tell us what's going on, Jerry.
Well, that's what's going on, and they've done it because the SPLPC has called ADF a hate group. Research Council. Neither of those groups are hate groups, not remotely. They're very mainstream conservative Christian organizations. ADF in particular is very close to the judicial mainstream. How do I know? Because they've won so many Supreme Court cases. Even before, you know, some of the Trump appointees, they were winning federal cases. So very mainstream organization. What happened is the Southern Poverty Law Center became a scapegoat per hire organization. You could go to them, write a big check if you wanted to get them to label some organization you don't like as a hate group, and that's all been exposed. The Atlantic, New York Times have talked about it. So it started out as an organization opposed to the KKK and anti-African American groups, but pretty much they got to the point where any group which questioned the LGBTQ agenda could be labeled a hate group. And of course they went after the effective groups. ADF has won a lot. They've been very effective. Booted them out of the Smile program. I like the Smile program. We participate in it as Amazon customers, but to boot ADF out is a shame. Now ADF is doing something, they're kind of like doing something redemptive with this, which is that they launched, I'm on an advisory board for this, they launched a viewpoint diversity survey where they're going out to 100 companies and then later larger numbers of companies with a survey that says, do you respect viewpoint diversity for your employees, for your suppliers, because Amazon's in trouble with its suppliers, and also when it comes to product, if you're a social media company or you're a bookseller or whatever, do you censor based on content? So they're deciding not just to go out and grumble in a corner, just to like fundraise on victimhood status. They're saying, oh, we understand now. We've been fighting in the courts, and I would say this to we conservative Christians in general. And while that was happening, the left, the ideological extremists, took over the boardroom. We got to go back now and deal with the boardroom. And ADF is doing that, and a lot of other people are doing it as well. I think we can win there. We won in the courts, we won a lot with elections, and I think we can do even better. But we can't win if we don't show up and contest that ground.
Absolutely. And, you know, Amazon is, you know, the 950-pound gorilla in any room. I don't care what the room is called. And, you know, just to look at this on the surface, way back in the day, Southern Poverty Law Center did indeed help target organizations that were kind of running down below the radar screen that had ties to the KKK. I mean, really nasty hate groups that I think everybody and his brother, no matter what your political persuasion, could come to the table and say, yep, no, we all agree, that's a hate group. But to lump an organization like Alliance Defending Freedom into that group, not because they're promoting hate or racist policies, but simply having a difference of political opinion, or simply being that, well, they happen to be conservative, where the board of directors and the leadership of Amazon happens to be liberal, and then for the Southern Poverty Law Center to have the audacity to come in and characterize them as a hate group, I mean, that's just a field too far, in my opinion.
It is, and let me be blunt about this. ADF, as far as I can tell, is protecting people from hate groups.
That's right.
You know, these people who go out there and say, bake the cake or lose your business, right? Or you participate in our gay marriage as a photographer, or have your business taken away. That's hate, because there are plenty of florists who will participate in a gay wedding. There are plenty of bakers who will do that. So what's happening is people who hate Christians are going out of their way not to get a cake baked, not to get photos taken, not to get a floral arrangement. I mean, for Pete's sake, you can definitely find people who will do floral arrangements for gay weddings. I assure you. But they find someone who is an evangelical Christian, and they know they are, and they go in and make a non-good faith attempt to buy services, and then when that doesn't work, then they bring a legal complaint to put someone out of business. Now, who's the hater in that situation?
Yeah, exactly. Honestly, and, you know, the irony is the person
who says, listen, I'll bake a cake, but someone else can decorate it. I'll bake a cake for you, but somebody else has to do the writing. Oh, no, that's not good enough. Do this or get fined $100,000 and have your dream killed. I think we know who the hater is.
Well, and, you know, the irony here, too, is, you know, good old-fashioned capitalism used to look at this from the standpoint of if there's a firm or an organization out there that you don't want to do business with and you don't appreciate their policies or practices, the easiest way to send a message is to vote with your feet, meaning take your business somewhere else. You don't want to do business with me? Guess what? I don't want to do business with you either. And, you know, even the average restaurant has a right to maintain no shirt, no shoes, no service policy. So, yeah, it's really a field too far, and it's sad that things have been taken in this direction. And I think you're right that there needs to be some changes, not only in terms of the way consumers engage with organizations like this, but also in terms of who gets elected on these boards of directors and the kind of outlandish decisions that they are making. I mean, there was a day and an age when the average American corporation existed to produce a product, to find a need and fill it, and to provide jobs for people in a given community. It wasn't always about making political statements and engaging in degrees of ideology. You're manufacturing widgets. Just make the widget, sell the widget, and leave the politicking to the politicians. But I guess that's not good enough for them anymore. Jerry Bowyer, as we mentioned, is the publisher of Affluent Investor Daily. We invite you to get more information about Jerry's good work as well as this wonderful newsletter by going online to affluentinvestor.com. That's affluentinvestor.com. There's Jerry Bowyer. Jerry, we appreciate your time. Coming up on 15 away from the hour, that means it's time for me to step aside for a moment, but don't go away. We've got more coming your way as Lifeline continues right here on KFAX.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Right, so in addition to issues like the environment, individualized attention, certainly extracurriculars, as we've just discussed, undoubtedly for most parents, job number one, academic standards. We've often heard the stories that students will walk across the stage on graduation day, be handed their graduation diploma, and be incapable of actually reading it. Now, I understand that's a bit of an exaggeration, but not by much. Give us your perspective, Sagar, in terms of what do the academic standards look like in private education versus public?
Well, statistics back up the fact that private schools challenge students to meet a higher academic standard. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, private high schools list more vigorous graduation requirements than their public school counterparts, requiring more coursework to be completed. The result is a graduating student body that performs better on tests, has a higher level of written, verbal, and mathematic ability, and has a more impressive school matriculation.
One thing that we often hear is that the child that matriculates through a private school going on to a two-year or four-year college or university, there's a significantly higher number of students that place into that higher level learning. And typically, I understand, their performance even on things like the SAT, the entrance scores, are higher.
Yes, students typically score 60 to 70 points above average on the SAT. Students from typical private schools have gone to attend the top colleges and universities in the nation.
Well, that certainly is exciting news, and I know will be very encouraging to every parent listening right now. And if you've tuned in a bit late, we're in studio with our general manager, Sagar Cannon. We're talking about this very special back-to-school program that we here at the station have operated for well over a decade now, affording parents, listeners like you, the opportunity to send your child to a first-year private school at half the regular tuition rate. Now, there are certainly some standards that need to be met. In other words, whatever the local schools academic requirements are in order to qualify for an entrance to a private school. They all remain the same. And you'll find details again on our website at halfofftuitions.com. That's halfofftuitions.com. There you'll also discover an interactive map that will show all of the participating schools around the greater San Francisco Bay Area. If, by the way, there happens to be a school very near your home that you don't see is there, feel free to contact us, and we'll be happy to talk to that school to see if we can open up an opportunity for your student to have a chance to go to that school first year at half off the regular tuition rate. Again, go to halfofftuitions.com, or easier still, call us toll-free at 800-947-5329. That's 800-947-5329, or online at halfofftuitions.com. Sagar, there's another important point that really is foundational to even the entirety of our conversation today about private school, and that is simply this. While parents are undoubtedly concerned about the kind of socialization their student is involved with, the kind of extracurricular activities, as we discussed, to be sure, academic standards, very important. But the one thing I hear repeated from parents, and that is, for them, first and foremost, they don't want to have a scholastic environment that competes with the values that they're raising their child with at home or at church. Talk to us about the sense of how these schools operate in relationship to what I'll call a values-centric education.
Well, all the private schools we partner with are very Christ-centered and values-oriented education. Christian education provides a biblical foundation for every child, with spiritual and moral formation at the forefront of everything. These schools focus on developing a caring community where students, faculty, and staff encourage one another in both the good and the difficult seasons of life. At an age where children discover their identity, a Christian school can help facilitate the shaping of their character by blending wisdom and knowledge in the curriculum. Some of a Christian school's fundamental beliefs include learning about character development, morals and ethics in light of the gospel. Christian schools integrate service opportunities into coursework and spiritual development opportunities.
Wow, that's great, because, you know, in the end, when we talk about education, it's not just preparing a child academically for a career, but training them up morally and in terms of character for a life. So toward that end, the difference that is available to parents in the private or parochial education environment is vastly contrasted against public education, where oftentimes not only is there inferior performance at the academic level for students, but then some of the issues we've addressed in our conversation today, be it violence in the classroom, opposing moral viewpoints, whatever these matters might be of concern to parents, you're just going to find a very different atmosphere, and one that will afford your son or daughter a real opportunity at the kind of firm foundation they need to be successful in business, their chosen career, and ultimately to be successful in life. Let's spend a moment as we conclude our conversation reviewing for the benefit of listeners exactly how the half-off tuition program works.
All the parent has to do is go to the website, that's halfofftuition.com. And if there is a school they are interested in what grade it is, they contact us. We'll contact the school. Then the school will contact them. And then they only pay half off after they qualify, after their children qualify to be enrolled in the school. Simple as that. Just three steps.
So long as they meet the entrance requirements, it's
yes,
individual to every school.
Every
and again,
school.
You'll find complete details by going to halfofftuitions.com. Once they are accepted, and I want to mention that these vouchers are on a first-come, first-served basis, so there should be a sense of urgency, because oftentimes a school will offer a half a dozen or so, whatever that number might look like. Once those vouchers have all been claimed, then that's it.
That's it. Yeah, so we have a limited number of vouchers.
The faster you move, the better. And it's not unusual, I would imagine, too, for example, for grandparents to say, you know, I know it might be a bit of a challenge economically for my son or daughter, but we care enough about our grandkids that we want to give this gift of education. So toward that end, can a grandparent purchase one of these vouchers for a grandchild?
Well, anybody can purchase this voucher for any one of them who qualifies based upon the school requirement, and they can go into our website and look at all the qualifications. If they have any question, they can either email us or call us.
And again, I want to mention that this is for first-time enrollment, so if a student is already enrolled, they don't qualify for the program. This is only good for the first year of tuition.
Yes.
And that raises a question. Some parents listening think, well, you know, if I go in and take advantage of the voucher for the first year, what happens the second year? Do you find cases where parents manage to find a way when they see the difference that private education is making?
Exactly. That's the whole idea. If it is up to us, we'll be happy to just give you for the lifelong of the child, but the school also needs to operate, and they also have certain expenses. So both the school and us, we agree that the first year will make a lot of difference, and the parents will see the difference that makes in their children, and we'll find a way to just help them continue their education throughout.
And, ultimately, this kind of a foundation, an educational foundation, ultimately becomes a gift of a lifetime for a child. So let's urge you to get more information by going to halfofftuitions.com. That's halfofftuitions.com. There you'll find complete details as to how the Half Off Tuitions program works. You'll also see a list of schools that are offering vouchers throughout the San Francisco Bay Area. And don't be bashful. If there's a school nearby your home that isn't listed, drop us a note. We'll be happy to contact them and see if we can't invite them to participate in the Half Off Tuitions program. Again, online at halfofftuitions.com. That's halfofftuitions.com, or call toll-free 800-947-5329. That's 800-947-5329. You've helped administer this program for many, many years, both here and in another state. I'm curious, from your perspective, Sagar, when you get a phone call from a parent and their child has just finished, say, their first semester, what's the typical reaction? What kind of reports are you hearing back from the parents as to the difference this program is making in the life of their child?
Well, I've had a lot of stories and testimonies from parents, but, you know, to generalize it, you know, usually they are so grateful and thankful for us to have such a program that was affordable for them to send their child, and at the end to see the difference it has made in their children, not only academically, but also in their character, and overwhelmingly in their walk with the Lord, and all that combined with their social life as well, has changed, because in public school it's very different compared to the private.
Undoubtedly
school.
So. And that life balance between the academic, the social, and ultimately the spiritual is so critically important, undoubtedly, to each of you listening right now. Maybe you've frequently thought about the difference that a private education might mean for your son or daughter, your grandson, your granddaughter, but the economics seem to be a bit challenging. Here's an opportunity to enroll your child for the first time at half off the regular tuition price, therefore aptly named the Half Off Tuition Program. You can get more details online at halfofftuitions.com. That's halfofftuitions.com. And again, more information related to exactly how the program works, all the schools that are currently participating. And at the end of the day, I think, Sagar, this is something where, as I suggested before, for a parent enrolling their child in a private school, this is not just a gift of education. It is literally the gift of a lifetime.
It's a beginning step for them. It makes a huge difference for them. You know, it will just lay a roadmap for them for the rest of their life.
Your child has one opportunity, and one opportunity only, to get a healthy educational start in life. Give them the best chance they've got. Go online and get more information today. Go to halfofftuitions.com. That's halfofftuitions.com. Or alternately, you can call with questions toll-free at 800-947-5329. That's 800-947-5329. Or once again at halfofftuitions.com. I'd like to thank my guest, our general manager, Sagar Cannon. Sagar, thank you for coming in and sharing this program with our listeners. I can't wait to hear the reports 6 months to a year from now, from parents who have listened today, went online, got the information, purchased the voucher, and then hear the exciting news of the difference that they've already seen in just 1 year in their own child's life.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, Craig. I really appreciate it. Our goal is to impact one life at a time, one community at a time. So I'm glad this will be available to more people than we have been able to touch.
And remember, it's first come, first serve, so don't delay. Get more information today. Go to halfofftuitions.com. That's halfofftuitions.com. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of Lifeline. Thanks so much for being with us. And if there was anything you heard on today's show that you'd like to hear again or share with a friend, grab a copy of the Lifeline podcast. Simply log on to KFAX.com. That's KFAX.com for the Lifeline podcast. Our producer is Wanda Sanchez. I'm Craig Roberts. Till next time round, remember, just don't keep the faith. Get out there and share it and make it a great evening. So long.
Opinions expressed in the preceding program do not necessarily represent the views of the ownership, staff, or management of KFAX. Copyright Salem Communications, all rights reserved. Let's leave the next generation a better world. Remember, we are called to be salt and light. AM 1100 KFAX San Francisco. Or find us at oneplace.com. Sponsored by Hilton.